our annual in-house council conference coming back to Chicago on Friday, June 6th. It started in Chicago 4 years ago, and we moved it to Houston just this last May. It was a wonderful event. We had a keynote speech by Viet Dinh, and now it's going to come back to Chicago. So please mark your calendars, Friday, June 6th in Chicago at the Ritz. Now it is my distinct pleasure to introduce Chief Judge Pryor for this panel on litigation environment.
Good afternoon. Theories of nuisance, market share, and consumer protection liability have become increasingly popular among plaintiffs who cannot trace an alleged harm to any specific defendant. Recently, states and local governments have sought to impose market share liability on companies based on allegedly misleading statements or silence about the potential effect of their products. These cases raise difficult legal issues that remain underdeveloped because the risk of a crippling damages award often pressures companies to settle claims early in the litigation. To discuss this topic, the Federalist Society has, as usual, assembled a distinguished panel of experts. I will introduce them in the order that they will speak. Regrettably, a professor at Georgetown who had been slated as a defender of this litigation canceled at the last minute, but we nevertheless have a great panel. Ted Boutros is a partner at Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher and is a member of the firm's executive and management committees. He's a member of the American Law Institute and a fellow of the American Academy of Appellate Lawyers. He has represented clients in the federal and state appellate courts throughout the nation in a wide spectrum of cases and has argued appeals before the Supreme Court of the United States. Albert Lynn is a partner at Hunton Andrews Kurth LLP and chairs the firm's issues and appeals practice. He's been a litigator in the Honors Program, a trial attorney in the Honors Program for the United States Department of Justice, and for 4.5 years served as Solicitor General for the state of West Virginia. I should also mention that he served as a law clerk to Justice Clarence Thomas in 2010 term, but he also previously clerked for me. O.H. Skinner is executive director for the Alliance for Consumers, where he leads Alliance for Consumers fighting to ensure that consumer protection efforts, class action lawsuits, and attorney general enforcement actions are consistent with the rule of law and benefit everyday consumers. Mr. Skinner clerked for the judge who I still refer to as my chief, Larry Edmondson of the 11th Circuit. Judge Edmondson was the chief when I became a member of that court. Ted.
Thank you, Chief Judge Pryor. Before I dive in, a personal note, as many of you know, my dear friend and law partner, Ted Olson, died earlier this week. Ted loved the Federalist Society and the rule of law and the Constitution. It seems very fitting and makes me feel better to be here today with all of you. I remember my first Federalist Society event. Ted said, came to my office and said, come with me. There's this Federalist Society meeting at the Mayflower across the street from our office. I didn't even know what the Federalist Society was. We went over, and the afternoon speaker was President Reagan. He was in a tan suit, which was very interesting to me. He gave a great speech, and I thought this Federalist Society is a very interesting group. So on to our topic. The law, the doctrine of public and private nuisance and similar theories have become the weapon of choice for plaintiffs' lawyers in a wide array of areas. I'm going to give you a report from the field in the most active and dangerous battleground. The wave of climate change litigation brought by cities, counties, municipalities, two Indian tribes, represented by private plaintiffs' lawyers in state courts under state law around the country against energy companies and only energy companies, just one sliver of the universe of people and entities that are contributing to greenhouse gas emissions and climate change. There's a lot going on. There are 34 cases and counting since this wave of state litigation and state law litigation began in 2017, and it ranges from Maui to Hoboken, San Francisco to Chicago to Charleston to Wilmington, Delaware. I represent Chevron. I'm proud to do so, and have been arguing the motions to dismiss now that we've been back in state court after seeking to remove to federal court. We're back in state court in all these cases, and I feel a little bit like I'm on a baseball team traveling the circuit here, and just getting to see the legal systems of all these different jurisdictions. It's an interesting thing to do, but we're trying to stop it from continuing. The plaintiff's theories in these cases is, to say the least, novel. They argue that the defendants owe them billions of dollars in damages under state law because the defendants made alleged misrepresentations and failed to warn around the world about climate change and climate change policy, and that supposedly increased greenhouse gas emissions beyond reasonable levels, allegedly causing local harm back in their own jurisdictions. And so they do not limit their claims to in-state activities or in-state emissions. In fact, they adamantly oppose the notion that their claims could be anything other than totally global. So they have used misrepresentation as their theory, and the argument is that the companies downplayed or made false statements about climate change. By the way, they don't ever identify a single statement, for example, that Chevron made, but nonetheless, it's attacking speech around the globe over a period of about 75 years. When plaintiffs we've challenged them, I've argued some of these cases, and every time I say to the judge, I think if you ask my opponent, he will say their claims are not limited to in-state conduct. They are global, and that they absolutely are. Sweeping doesn't begin to describe these claims. The claims they plead, while identified by familiar labels like nuisance, failure to warn, trespass, consumer fraud, look nothing like any of those tort claims. I think that's why nuisance has become so popular. The Supreme Court has said in the Ouellette case that it's the vague and indeterminate standards. Anything can be sort of, theoretically branded a nuisance. Judge Wilkinson in the Fourth Circuit said, talked about the variety of things nuisance law has been applied to, none of which has anything to do with something like a global issue like climate change. It's more like your neighbor is making a mess and it's affecting you or it's affecting the public. Prosser and Keaton would be shocked if they heard about this new tort theory and how it's being applied. While the plaintiffs' claims in these cases hinge on the repeated assertions that the defendants concealed important information about climate change, leading to this increase in greenhouse gas emissions, globally, the relationship and the things they say that the energy companies knew about dating back 30 or 40 or 50 years was widely known. And President Johnson in 1965 announced that the climate was changing, and we've had the world's best scientists since then and before then, working on these issues, talking about these issues, how to deal with them, how to balance the policy of energy needs and national security versus the environment and the climate. It's been widely known. In fact, the plaintiffs in these cases had enormous amounts of information. Some of them passed laws 10, 20 years ago on these very issues. The big news is we have a cert petition pending in the Supreme Court asking it to review the one outlier, the main outlier decision that has at least allowed these claims to go past the motion to dismiss stage, the Hawaii Supreme Court's decision in a case that Honolulu brought. Nuisance, all these cases basically have the same theory. Nuisance is the headline, and then they add some other claims that sound a lot like their nuisance claim. The Hawaii ruling squarely conflicts with the Second Circuit's ruling in the case that had been brought by the City of New York, and that decision came down a few years ago. And so we've got a clear, clean conflict of authority on an issue of great national importance. We have really strong amicus support. The court has called for the views of the Solicitor General. We're waiting that brief. Plus, 19 states have filed an original petition, 19 states who say these other states, if they create torts for global activity, are going to be intruding on our prerogatives as states, and I'll come back to that. And so the court, Supreme Court, is a pretty unusual thing for states to file an original petition. Alabama led the charge here. The Supreme Court has asked for the views of the Solicitor General in that case too. So we're optimistic, or at least hopeful, that the Supreme Court will weigh in, because otherwise we are going to have years and years of litigation in cases that are ultimately doomed to fail, either as a matter of federal law or state law. We have many strong dispositive arguments under state law in these cases. For all the reasons I mentioned, they're just novel theories that don't fit into any tort. But our overarching argument is a federal one, that the structure of our federal constitution precludes application of state law under these circumstances and requires dismissal. And the reason that is that the Supreme Court has repeatedly, consistently held for over a century that our federal constitutional structure means that state law cannot be used to resolve disputes involving interstate air or water pollution, precisely because of their inherently interstate nature. Justice Ginsburg for the court in AEP, rejecting federal common law climate change cases, said that the basic scheme of the Constitution demands that federal law be the only potential source for a claim in this area, because if each state is trying to use tort law to regulate the same emissions and the same activities around the globe, it would be a clash of the prerogatives of the state. The Supreme Court, in a case called Milwaukee 1, said there's an overriding federal interest in federal rule, and that basic interests of federalism require that federal law, not state law, govern disputes involving air and water in their ambient or interstate aspects. So we argue that that body of law requires, precludes state law from applying. And as I mentioned, the chaos that would ensue if all these cities and municipalities and states are all applying their state law to things that happen all over the globe, including in states that do not want these lawsuits to proceed, that say your speech is true, we need energy, we reject these tort claims, but these cases would necessarily be imposing liability for lawful activity in these other states. The Supreme Court in a Clean Water Act case said that it would lead to chaotic confrontation between sovereign states if states were allowed to apply their own law to out-of-state emissions or sources of pollution. The Supreme Court most recently, in an opinion authored for the court by Justice Thomas, Franchise Tax Board, put it this way in 2019, the Constitution implicitly forbids the exercise of power by a state because the interstate nature of the controversy makes it inappropriate for state law to control, and only federal rules, whether they find a cause of action or not, can apply. And as I said, that's exactly what these claims are all about. Plaintiffs are seeking to impose nuisance liability under state tort law for the effects of interstate and global emissions based on defendants' speech and conduct occurring across every state and every nation on the planet, involving the actions of billions of people and entities in those other jurisdictions. The Second Circuit in the City of New York case that I mentioned agreed with our constitutional structure arguments, said that stripped to the essence, the city's claim was whether, the question before the court was whether a nuisance suit seeking to recover damages for harms allegedly caused by global greenhouse gas emissions may proceed under New York law. Our answer is simple, no. The court said that such sprawling claims which seek damages for cumulative impact of conduct occurring simultaneously across just about every jurisdiction on the planet are simply beyond the limits of state law. And the gist of it is that because of the interstate and international nature of the claims, only the principles of federalism, foreign policy, the Clean Air Act, the relationships among the states preclude one state from using its tort law that way. And the Second Circuit noted that for over a century, the Supreme Court had held just that. I want to be clear, our argument is not that a state cannot regulate emissions or cannot have torts that affect emissions. And our argument is not necessarily that a state can't have a tort that targets misleading speech. And I know my fellow panelists are going to talk a little bit about this within the state or even outside the state that may have cause harm in the state. But what the state, in fact, the Clean Air Act contemplates that states can establish emission standards, and they have a responsibility to do it under for their own state. They can regulate within their borders, but it forbids the states from imposing liability, in our view, or regulating and punishing for emissions in another state where those emissions may be perfectly lawful under that state law. Since the Second Circuit, we've had several rulings. The only one that the Hawaii Supreme Court ruled against us in this string of cases, and at least allowed the case to go forward beyond motion to dismiss. But in July, a Maryland trial court judge reached exactly the same conclusion as the Second Circuit in basically an identical case, finding that our federal constitutional structure does not allow application of state law to claims like those that were being made because of the reasons I just mentioned. In January, the Delaware trial court reached the same conclusion in virtually identical cases, finding that these claims are beyond state law. The Delaware court allowed claims based on in-state activities and in-state emissions to go forward. The state of Delaware said, we don't want any part of that. We do not want to bring that claim. That's not our claim. Our claim is about global emissions. So they're seeking the ability to appeal that immediately. So we believe we've got a very strong cert petition with the split with Hawaii, and these issues are clearly of national and international importance, so really well-suited to Supreme Court review. The last point I want to make is that these are not new issues. It's sort of like I'm in a recurring dream here, in the sense that in the early 2000s, governmental entities started bringing cases under federal common law, and they argued that, you know, recognizing that the only body of law that could conceivably apply was federal law, they argued that there should be federal common law tort climate change cases. One of the first cases involved all the automakers, and I represented all the automakers in that case back in 2006 and 2007, and a case brought by the California Attorney General, and we won. The district judge was in federal court, found that this is just not something courts could handle. This was a policy question, a political question. The Kivalina case from the Ninth Circuit involved many of the same energy companies who are now being sued. The Ninth Circuit held such claims cannot go forward because this is an issue committed to Congress and to the EPA. And the American Electric Power case, which I mentioned earlier, we call it AEP, where Justice Ginsburg, writing for a unanimous court, emphatically rejected global warming tort claims, finding that global warming, climate change pose complex balancing choices between scientific issues, issues of national and international policy, energy needs, the environment, and that falls within the Clean Air Act zone, the EPA zone. It's a policy issue. It's just not something suitable for courts, federal courts, to resolve. We argue, well, if federal courts aren't suitable for resolving these issues, how can zillions of state courts around the country be the ones making these very, very delicate determinations? I'll pause.
Okay. Thank you, Ted. Albert.
Do we have to turn these on?
No.
Okay. All right. I guess good afternoon. I have morning written here. Thank you to the Federal Society for the opportunity to speak today. I'm honored to be here with my old boss, Judge Pryor, and two really excellent lawyers, Ted and OH. So in my opening remarks, I'm going to talk A little bit, I'm gonna pull back a little bit and talk more generally about public nuisance, which I think is a threat not only to the energy sector, but to pretty much any industry, as I hope will become clear. So I have essentially two points. The first is, I believe that the way public nuisance has been used over the past several decades, but particularly in the last decade, is ahistorical and inconsistent with the rule of law. And furthermore, I believe that state legislatures need to step in to address this problem. So let's take a little trip back in time. Public nuisance, which should not be confused with private nuisance, right? So private nuisance, you've got your neighbor is doing something that is affecting you. Public nuisance is a cause of action that dates back to medieval England. And for centuries, courts have treated public nuisance as a narrow legal action, mainly for governmental entities to abate, so stop, reduce, remove, a localized criminal or quasi-criminal interference with a public right. And so what does that mean? So that's, think about, and so by public right, the courts meant things like the ability to navigate down a river, drive down a public highway. So a sort of a quintessential public nuisance was a felled tree obstructing a public road. There have been at least 5 important limitations on this narrow cause of action. First, as the name suggests, a public nuisance required the involvement of a public right. This is just discussing, not just something that affects the public. So the Rhode Island Supreme Court once wrote that the longstanding principle is that a public right is a right of the public to shared resources such as air, water, or public rights of way. Second, a public nuisance has almost always involved land of some kind. So either a defendant's obstruction of land, so it's just discussing like the felled tree, or at least the defendant's offensive use of land. The third important limitation was that public nuisance, and this is perhaps one of the most important ones, public nuisance has long required unlawful and not just unreasonable conduct. So put another way, a public nuisance did not arise from lawful conduct. And let's put a pin in that point because we'll come back to that, and I think that's really sort of where the worm started to turn on public nuisance, is this understanding that public nuisance is about unreasonable interference with public rights and not unlawful interference with public rights. The fourth limitation was that the remedies and the plaintiffs have always been limited. So public nuisance was mainly for governmental plaintiffs and only for those governmental plaintiffs to seek to stop or abate the nuisance, not to seek damages. Private plaintiffs, there's a narrow exception that was recognized for private plaintiffs to seek damages, but only for those who suffered a special injury. And so what does that mean, special injury? So it's somebody who is harmed more uniquely than the public at large, right? Because we're talking about public nuisances, and the government should be vindicating the right to the access to the public right. So what's a person with a special injury? So let's come back to the felled tree example. Maybe a person who was hit by the tree when the tree fell, or a person who was going down the road in their horse-drawn carriage and swerved to avoid the tree, right, and crashed into the ditch on the side. Those might be people with special injuries. They could bring their own public nuisance action and seek damages, but it's a limited, narrow subset of people. And then the fifth limitation, sort of follows from the limited remedy of seeking abatement, is that a public nuisance defendant had to have control of the nuisance and actually cause any alleged harm from it. And that makes sense, right? If the remedy is abatement, a defendant cannot stop or remove or abate a nuisance that it does not have control over. And one place where this sort of really easily comes up is a public nuisance was used to sue lead paint companies in the 90s. And oftentimes the lead paint was, companies no longer had control of the lead paint, right? It was in buildings, it was put there by a variety of intervening causes and actors. So we had these 5 longstanding limitations on public nuisance that kept it to be a fairly controlled and narrow cause of action. This all started to change in the 1970s, and particularly in 1979 with the second restatement of torts, which took on for the first time the task of defining public nuisance. And it's funny, Ted mentioned Prosser and Keaton. So the initial reporter for the second restatement of torts was in fact William Prosser. And he presented a draft that defined public nuisance as a criminal interference. That was rejected. Prosser resigned. At the urging of environmental activists, the new reporter reported a draft that ultimately expanded the legal action beyond criminal interferences to also address any, quote, unreasonable interference with a right common to the general public. And unreasonable was then defined as any conduct that, quote, involves a significant interference with the public health, the public safety, the public peace, the public comfort, or the public convenience. So basically anything. So that's 1979, and so unsurprisingly, lawsuits have since sought to label all manner of things as public nuisances by way of their unreasonably affecting the public. Ted talked for a while about climate change lawsuits, but there's a long list of things that have been labeled a public nuisance in lawsuits. Firearms, lead paint, subprime mortgages, pharmaceutical products of all kinds, particularly opioids recently, marketing and sale of fossil fuels, cars that are more frequently stolen. Those are a lawsuit that was brought recently. PFAS, plastics. Recent lawsuit was dismissed. The Attorney General of New York brought up plastics. Public nuisance lawsuit. You name it, it's probably been done. And in doing this, plaintiffs have urged courts to abandon all of the traditional principles of public nuisance. So public rights are no longer limited to shared resources like air, water, and public rights of way. They are now whatever generally widespread social ill or public policy concern that legislation or regulation has not, in the eye of the plaintiff's bar, adequately addressed. Public nuisance is no longer tied to a use of or obstruction of land. It has been used to target the manufacture, distribution, marketing, and sale of indisputably lawful and non-defective products, and often years after those products have left the control of the defendants with multiple intervening and independent causes and actors. So as I said, how did that lead paint get in your house? Where did those opioids come from? Finally, the plaintiffs and the remedies are expanding too. Governmental plaintiffs are seeking damages. They call it abatement, but they call it an abatement fund. So it's not just abatement, but they're seeking a pot of money to pay for the abatement. And that, the seeking of damages, has led to contingent fee litigation creeping into this space, which has led to an explosion in the number of governmental entities. So in the past, maybe it was just the state that had the resources to bring these kinds of suits, but with the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, you can now have counties and municipalities and school boards and little tiny governmental entities that before would not have had the resources to bring these suits, but now can sign a contingent fee contract. And so you've got an innumerable number of plaintiffs. And finally, private plaintiffs are trying to bring public nuisance suits without any showing of special injury. And so in short, courts are being urged to use public nuisance as a roving mandate to correct whatever societal problems they want to correct and to impose huge amounts of monetary liability. The Eighth Circuit, in a 1993 case, described these new public nuisance theories as turning that cause of action into, quote, a monster that would devour in one gulp the entire law of tort. New Jersey Supreme Court said that these theories would stretch the concept of public nuisance far beyond recognition and create a new and entirely unbounded tort. That was in a lead paint case. And so it's not hard, at least for me, to see how this is a huge threat to the rule of law. This approach to public nuisance means a company's completely lawful product or conduct today might be deemed a nuisance tomorrow, a year from now, or 10 years from now. And in some cases, as in the case of fossil fuels, public nuisance has been asserted against not only lawful conduct, but conduct expressly authorized or encouraged by the government. As the Supreme Court of Oklahoma recently observed, this is in an opioid case that went the right way, businesses have no way to know whether they might face nuisance liability for manufacturing, marketing, or selling products, i.e., will a sugar manufacturer of the fast food industry be liable for obesity? Will an alcohol manufacturer be liable for psychological harms? Or will a car manufacturer be liable for health hazards from lung disease, to dementia, or for air pollution. An appellate court in New York put it more bluntly, quote, all a creative mind needs to do is construct a scenario describing a known or perceived harm of a sort that can somehow be said to relate back to the way a company or an industry makes, markets, or sells its non-defective lawful product or service, and a public nuisance claim can be conceived and a lawsuit born. These suits have been met with only mixed success in court. Some of these quotes that I've given you are from cases that have rejected these public nuisance theories, but some success is enough when the potential scope of liability is huge, right? You've taken simple statistics, do the simple expected value calculation. If a $100 billion lawsuit has a 1% chance of succeeding, it's still an enormously big risk. And so while, for example, the New York AG's plastic lawsuit was dumped out of court recently in a fairly strongly worded opinion, there have been successful opioid and lead paint public nuisance lawsuits. And so what is the predictable result of this? Huge settlements. For example, in 2022, Walmart announced a $3.1 billion, with a B, settlement to resolve opioid-related lawsuits brought by state and local governments. CVS announced in a similar time frame that it had settled similar lawsuits for approximately $5 billion. So what can be done? Well, I think one solution is state legislation. While judges must, of course, continue to resist creative attempts to expand public nuisance law, legislators can craft statutes that restore and codify the traditional limits of public nuisance. As an example, they could define a narrow set of activities that constitute a public nuisance. One example is a law in the state of Arizona that says a public nuisance, and hopefully this will sound familiar, constitutes anything that, quote, unlawfully obstructs the free passage or use in the customary manner of any navigable lake, river, bay, stream, canal, or basin, or any public park, square, street, or highway. That tracks the traditional understanding of what a public right is. Conversely, state legislation could say what a public nuisance cannot be. And this has happened, there are a number of statutes out there for the firearms industry, as well as what are called right to farm laws, protecting the agricultural industry. All 50 states have enacted right to farm laws that prevent public nuisance claims against certain categories of agricultural activities. Other examples of things that could be done is you could have a statute that requires causation or control of the public nuisance. Could limit remedies to abatement and bar workarounds like abatement funds that are really just damages in another form. And finally, another sort of outside the box path, which Judge Pryor might appreciate from his state AG days, is to prevent municipalities from bringing public nuisance lawsuits for issues that are of statewide concern and to require those to go at a minimum through the state AG's office. So that's all I have for now, and I look forward to our discussion.
Okay, thank you. OH?
So I'm not going to talk to you about case names or restatements or anything else. I think that both of these presentations have explained from people who actually litigate these cases on the ground, and I think issues of causation and issues of in-state versus out-of-state, I think those are important. I think at a fundamental level, it's important to recognize that the concept is quite simple. People who bring these claims identify a nuisance, and then, and Elbert's right, and Ted are more specific, but like at a fundamental level, if you don't litigate these cases, it looks like this. I find a nuisance, the nuisance is bad. I go after the person who contributed to the nuisance and I make them fix it. Because really what you're supposed to have at the end of one of these cases is abatement. And what does abatement mean? It means you take away the nuisance. If that's a tree or something, you can understand that. But here, what is that? What is a climate change case really? Climate change is a problem. Fix climate change. Gun violence is a problem. Fix gun violence. Right? Plastic pollution is a problem. Fix pollution. I'm simplifying it because I think when you understand it like that, you can understand why this gets to be very confusing to a court or to anybody else, right? So I'm going to start with two examples of how that's fine. right? I think it's important to talk about how public nuisance is a fine thing to bring. It's a little hard because people talk about a tree over a road and a carriage, and your first thought is like, well, why do you need a lawsuit for that? You just have, like, the Public Works Department clear the road. I know that in West Virginia, maybe, or you know, they're not always sure about whether they have this, but you fix it, right? Why you got to sue somebody over that? Okay, well, I'll use two examples that have happened in recent years that I think are totally fine exercises of nuisance, okay? There's a literal sriracha factory in the L.A. area. I think it's L.A., might be Orange County. It doesn't matter. In Southern California. And, like, the pepper stuff is getting out of the stacks, and it's making everybody not be able to go outside their homes because it's burning their eyes and their throats. So let's assume that that is actually happening and not that, like, that's false claims. Fine. You bring a nuisance claim, and you tell the factory, what do you want them to do? Stop that, put scrubbers, or stop operating. Whatever it is, make that stop. Kids need to play outside. People need to go outside. Okay. In Phoenix, where I live, the city was allowing a homeless encampment. Now, there's a dispute about whether this is a public or private nuisance case, but it doesn't really matter. There's a homeless encampment, it's in the middle of the road, and the city won't do anything about it. So what do the bar owners and restaurant owners do? They bring a nuisance claim, and what is what they want? That campment goes away. You abate that. Okay, you can picture what those are. Okay, so why? Why are they really doing this? You know, I think Ted explained why this is, you know, they're trying to get a lot of money, and Albert's talking about money. I see these differently. There's a lot of other ways to get money from people. If you think about Ted's cases from my perspective, what do you got? You've got people who couldn't get a Green New Deal through Congress, or as a person in this room and a very prominent American will say, the Green New scam. And what you get is they can't get something through Congress. And they figure out that they want to go after something very large. They need to access a large pool of capital to fundamentally change the American economy. Okay, well, what's convenient about a common law claim for nuisance? There's a couple of things that are very, very convenient if you're an activist. There's no statute of limitations, and the claim can be brought by a local government. Now, something that's not well known to people in this room, but is very well known to me and maybe to Albert as well, is if you want to bring a consumer fraud claim in almost every state in the country that isn't California, that's a state claim because it's a statutory claim. The power is given to the Attorney General. So the city of the city of Glendale in Arizona cannot bring a consumer fraud claim, but they can bring a public nuisance claim. How convenient is that? Okay, there's no statute of limitations. Local governments can access these cases, and if you make the nuisance big enough, you start to realize that this is a very convenient tool. It's a very convenient tool to do something that's very, very, very bad for most people's perspectives, which is you take an industry you don't like, and you effectively confiscate the net worth of the industry, turn it into a fund managed by government agents, and then deploy that capital for your ideological goals. Now, if you were to do this through Congress, let's just say, people would be very upset if you just said, the oil and gas industry shall hereby not exist, all their assets are turned over to the Oil and Gas Industry Punishment Fund, which will now give out money to pay for, you know, wind farms and solar cells and all that stuff, right? There'd be a takings claim. I think a lot of people in Congress would probably not vote for this. There would be a lot of upset. I don't see the public nuisance cases over climate change as very different. Similarly, gun violence in America is a major problem. We shall hereby bankrupt the entire firearms industry, shut down everybody who sells bullets and guns, and then we will take all their assets, put them into a fund to abate the gun violence problem. How shall we do that? Well, we'll build homeless shelters, we'll build these things, we'll pay for schools. I mean, I'm really trying to make this clear. Like, in one county in Oregon, their claims for public nuisance over climate change are $52 billion. What do they intend to do with that money? They intend to spend that money, the county, on retrofitting buildings, putting in things that they could, you know, things that sound like what, you know, taxpayers would normally pay for, to retrofit, green fit, do all the various words, right? Okay, so to me, this is just a plan to reshape the American society in a way that is ideological in nature, and the money that is very concerning to my colleagues up here and very concerning to a defendant, the money is just the fuel. The money is just I've now taken from you, so I now can spend without having to appropriate it from any other source or raise taxes or print bonds or really do anything else with it, right? It's just a fuel tool for what you want to do. And I think it's important to understand when you talk about any of these topics. I think Albert alluded to this. Ted speaking for oil, the oil industry, or the energy industry, I don't know what language we use today, but if climate change is a problem, and if the energy industry is a problem because they took the oil out of the ground and they sold it, so they contributed to climate change, you see, worldwide. There's a second, now the question is, well, where did it go? Okay, well, you sold it to a place that it was a power plant. Power plants are in trouble now, so anybody who is an energy producer or is in a utility, they're in trouble next. Okay, who else bought it? Well, somebody who owns a car. We can't go after them. The person who made the car, they also produced emissions. They are also liable for climate change. They need to pony up to pay for the climate change. Okay, who else? And it just goes down the road, right? I mean, this is it sounds hyperbolic until you look at a couple of the cases. Tish James, the Attorney General of New York, has recently sued JBS Foods. It's a consumer fraud claim, but what is the claim? Cows contribute to climate change. You said you'll be net zero. You're lying because you can't raise cows that are net zero. Okay, well, if that's true, let's just assume that that's true, then there's a public nuisance to JBS Foods because they produce cows. Cows produce climate change. Climate change is a problem. Let's undo climate change. JBS Foods, pay to the Undo Climate Change Fund. Worldwide. Stop it all. Okay, so I just want to make people understand that this is about guns, it's about cars, it's about food, it's about cows, it's about anything that is disfavored. And you might notice that the targets of all of this are they're disfavored by one side, not the other. Okay, that seems very convenient to me that that's how it's built. So I see this as an ideological thing. We built a website called publicnuisancerevealed.org. I don't see this as just a Proseron torts. I see this as this is an ideological weapon built for ideological ends, targeting industries that are disfavored and accessing capital to reshape America. So you should not like it for that reason alone. Okay? Now, let's try to tie this back to the law maybe. Problem number one, and maybe it's because I like states and I used to be the SG in Arizona, this violates every component of how we think about structuring our government and federalism, okay? One of the biggest issues at the panels here and in the courts in America right now is who decides, right?
Right.
I think every judge that goes on the bench nowadays is thinking in a case, who is supposed to decide this question of government, okay? What do you see with these public nuisance cases? You have local elevated over the state. You have a little city, a little county that's asking for $52 billion. I don't really know the budget of Oregon, but Oregon's not a very big state. $52 billion seems like a lot of money, you know, compared to the entire budget of the state of Oregon. You have local governments being given national power. Because if the goal is to abate climate change or gun violence, okay, let's just use two simple examples, that means that you're asking a defendant to change their behavior everywhere in the country. You can't abate your emissions in one state. If climate change is the problem, you have to shut down your actions in the whole country, in the whole world. So now one county gets a court order saying, stop contributing to climate change and pay for what you did in the past. Okay, well, how do you stop contributing to climate change? You have to stop everything you've done everywhere. How do you stop contributing to gun violence? You have to stop selling guns everywhere because they move around. So now you've got local elevator of the state, local given national power, given international power, and you have this extraterritoriality issue that's on steroids, right? It's not California regulating what you grow in Iowa to send into California. You have California literally telling companies you shall not sell something in Iowa because of the intermix of the air or the interstate roadways or any of those things, right? That's a really big problem. Because now you have little government school districts reaching out and fundamentally changing the economy, okay? As a practical matter, that's a real problem. That's not how our system is built, okay? Now you have a second problem that's very core to me that I care about, which is this is anti-consumer. It removes products. It's designed, from my perspective, to remove products from store shelves. You're not allowed to buy gas, you're not allowed to buy guns, you're not allowed to buy bullets, you're not allowed to buy beef. You're not allowed to buy plastic bottles. Okay, it's designed to obtain money, but none of that money goes to any consumer. The $3 billion opioid settlements, they pay for stuff, for things. No victim of an opioid death in their family receives any money from any of these cases. This has nothing to do with making somebody whole for something that happened to them in the past, even if we all agree that somebody died from opioids that should have never been given to them. It's not putting money into consumers, it's just putting money to governmental functions. That's bad. I spend a lot of my time arguing to governments why they should be returning money to consumers and not putting it in their own pockets, and this is just a system that they cannot give money to consumers, because how would that abate a nuisance? That's just a straight damages claim. So in both of those categories, it's terrible for our system of government and how we manage each other, and it's terrible for consumers. It doesn't help any everyday person. It just helps bureaucrats. These market share liability cases, which we haven't really talked about, I don't really know how it ended up in the agenda, but I think it's interesting, is you got a state like Vermont that's literally saying, we're going to figure out how much damage has been done to Vermont from climate change, then we're going to figure out what percentage of emissions each company that operates in Vermont or has ever operated in Vermont has contributed, and then we're going to assign them a percentage of their climate change liability. Okay, but then what does that money do? It just goes into the coffers of the state of Vermont. Right? None of this flows down to an actual person. Okay, so I think that's how people need to think about this. And I also think people need to think about what Elbert flagged, which is the early settlement risk. I think it's kind of interesting that these cases began with the Chevrons of the world, really big companies. Because if I were an insidious actor, I would actually begin with like the middle-sized companies. If climate change is an existential threat, the guy who's probably the least comfortable with this is like the, you know, the Van Tuys or somebody who owns a lot of car dealerships. Like enough car dealerships to be like a really deep pocket, but not enough to be Chevron and litigate and pay Ted's rates, very high, to pay Ted all the way through, right? So you go up to me and say, hey, I'm going to take $1 billion from you, or to Elbert's point, I'm going to sue you for $100 billion, and I got like a 10% chance of getting this, and if I get this, then I'm going to bankrupt your entire family because it's a privately owned business. Or you could just stop selling gas-powered cars and pay me like, I don't know, like $100 million. That's a hard moment for somebody who only has $1 billion as opposed to $100 billion. So ironically, they've gone after the deepest pockets. If they get the deepest pockets, the car dealers, the gas station owners, everybody down, a large farmer, somebody who watches like Yellowstone, those guys are going to get hit with an offer they can't refuse, which is change what you do, give me part of your money, or I take your entire net worth. And now you're going to start to see products wiped off the store shelves without any district judge or trial court judge doing anything. It's going to be done. It's just they cook it. So I think people have to think about it from that perspective, because it is not, I think it's an ideological tool as much as, and the money is about the ideology. Okay, now answer. I actually disagree with Elbert, so now see we've got our counterpoint going. I disagree with Elbert. I don't think legislation solves this. I think legislation solves it if you approach it from like Elbert's perspective, and just be clear, Elbert and I are very good friends. That lowers your liability share. So if your goal is to tamp down your overall amount of potential liability, you ban public nuisance in Texas, you ban it in Arizona, you ban it in, you know, I don't know, Florida's pretty red these days, you ban it in Alabama, life's getting better, right? Incrementally getting better. From my perspective, this does almost nothing, because California and Oregon will still be able to wipe away the products that I want people to be able to buy. Okay? Maybe the company has to spend a little bit less money for past abatement or something, but I'm mad because the end result of those cases is the product goes away. The bullets go away, the gun goes away, the Super Duty truck goes away. Some people like those. That's not very helpful. So you've got people who are spending a lot of money to try to pass bills that are incrementally making the liability share better for their interests, but don't actually stop the ideological war. And you're never going to pass a public nuisance ban in California or Oregon or Illinois or Washington State. It's just not going to happen. I say it's not going to happen because they know that it's an ideological tool that is available to them. You know, I wrote in the Wall Street Journal, as they lose access to levers of power in Congress or levers of power in state houses in more states, this is more important to the ideological goals that they're serving. So I don't think legislation does a whole lot. I mean, it helps some things and it helps some people, and that's fine, and I'm happy when people pass the bills, but if I were advising people, I would say don't do that, right? Because what you really need, and advocacy is not enough, you know, as many websites as I build. The ideal outcome is you do need the Supreme Court to step in. And I wish that the case that are sitting there were not about climate change, because I think it's more, and you know, and Ted and I talk about this a little differently, because I suspect we might have voted for somebody a little differently at some point in our lives. I don't know, just guessing.
It's happened.
You know, I've seen you on TV. The public nuisance cases that are on the verge of going to the Supreme Court are so much more powerful than some dispute over climate change, okay? Because what they really are presenting is, I think, a very, very interesting set of questions to this Supreme Court. If you look at the most important sets of cases in recent years, if you think about non-delegation doctrine, if you think about the major questions doctrine, if you even think about Loperbright and questions of deference, these are the who decides cases. These are the who has the power cases. These are the, do we really want to allow this much room to just be created in the student loan cases, in the vaccine mandate cases? Are we going to take something old and just allow it to swallow an existing regulatory structure, right? A court that's interested in non-delegation, that's interested in major questions, that's asking for clarity before the federal government can regulate the entirety of the U.S. economy, that thinks for the Clean Power Plan cases in West Virginia versus EPA, hey, before you're just allowed to do something that's of this scope and scale, we need something more specific from Congress. I'm sorry. Hey, that's how I think about major questions. I'm sure that's not exactly correct. For that court, the who gets to regulate the entirety of the energy industry in America? Who gets to approach climate change? Who's supposed to solve gun violence? Should we really have the city of San Mateo, or the county, and that's a county, I think, of San Mateo, controlling the entire American economy based on a common law doctrine? Maybe not. Maybe that's not how this works. It's not major questions, I want to be very clear, but it's the thinking that gets you the major questions doctrine should be piqued by this, right? And I would say that the best possible outcome, a lot of this is laid out in the state of Alabama's amicus brief in the cases that Ted's litigating, written by Eddie LaCour's Alabama Solicitor General, fantastic. Not here because he just had his fourth baby.
One of my law clerks.
See what I did there. Basically, the Supreme Court could take those cases and say something that would be deeply powerful, which is, public nuisance gets to stop things like the Sriracha factory. It gets to stop things like a tree downed on a road. It gets to stop a lot of things that are local. But if your identified nuisance is national in scale, then basically as motivated by the same thinking that gets you the major questions doctrine and a lot of the important case law on non-delegation, or the arguments at least around non-delegation, if that's your thing, if it's a national or international thing that you're trying to solve, that's not for you. That's not for your county court. That's not for your city government. That's not for any of this. That's something that we solve at a federal level. So no. If that's your situation, no. Now, what they don't have to say, but what the result of that is it nationwide gun violence? That's not a nuisance that gets solved from litigation. Is it international climate change? That's not solved by this. Is your problem that cows contribute to that? Great, don't care. The problem is national, international, you're done. It goes to a, we're gonna need Congress to solve that. We're gonna need a federal statute. We're gonna need something that's appropriately federal in nature, because we don't like or believe that you should have one county court in Multnomah County, Oregon, deciding whether we get to have gas stations everywhere or not.
Okay.
Right, so That actually solves this problem. And now it sends everyone back to the drawing board. If you want to reshape the American economy, you get to go to Congress. If you want to spend a bunch of money, you get to put in taxes. You can tax the oil and gas industry all to death in your state if you want. But what's interesting about taxing somebody is they can just leave your state. What's interesting about these climate change cases is they don't want you to leave, they just want all your money. I mean, I think that's important to think about. Like, if California doesn't want gas stations and wants to have a confiscatory tax, maybe somebody here will try to tell you you can't have confiscatory tax, take all the money in the state, all the profit in the state, fine. They're allowed to do that. It's terrible for California consumers, but they're allowed to do that. What they can't do is shut down the gas stations in Iowa and take all the money that's ever been made from international drilling in Ecuador and all the places that, you know, these companies do their things. That's not what we get to do, right? So you get the money the ways you're allowed to get the money. You don't get the money through this. And so I just think everyone should understand that you want these climate change cases to get granted, and you want the Supreme Court to weigh in, whatever your positions on climate change are, because you want this whole intellectual, ideological war against disfavored industries, of which the left has found more and more and more, to stop. You don't want nuisance to be available to describe anything that's bad and nationwide. You want it to stop. Okay. And that's what I would say.
Okay. Listening to this discussion reminds me, I feel like I'm in a time warp. it reminds me of my tenure as a state attorney general. I became a state attorney general in January of 97 after having previously served as the deputy for then state attorney general Jeff Sessions. And we were in the midst of what our neighboring states were calling the tobacco litigation. And those suits against the tobacco industry, an unpopular industry, public nuisance was a theory. By the way, I remember going to a meeting at the Chicago O'Hare Hilton, I think, where Attorney General Mike Moore was explaining the theories. I don't think this is attorney-client privilege because he never represented us, and we didn't agree with his theories. but his idea was, let's use public nuisance, state governments, against this industry. The relief sought was not abatement. They wanted to make the industry pay for the Medicaid costs of six smokers, notwithstanding the fact that the cigarette taxes that they collected from the six smokers were pretty big, and frankly, unfortunately, those smokers died earlier, so they had fewer Medicaid costs. None of that mattered. That was what, when I floated that, he called that the early death defense of the tobacco industry. No state, there was no statute of limitations, as you mentioned. But one of the things that he touted for this theory was that it also avoided a jury trial. The tobacco industry had been very successful historically in winning its litigation because they went to juries, and juries thought smokers knew the risk of smoking before they started smoking, and they didn't think much of the lawsuits. They had never lost a case. When they then tried to make it a political resolution through Congress, and that failed, then the tobacco industry and the state AGs got together and effectively created a cartel that protected the tobacco industry and created a stream of revenue for state governments. And just listening to this makes me think, though, OH, that maybe Elbert's theory that that some of these lawsuits might be combated through state legislative efforts. Some of this, if it's climate change and it involves the kinds of international and interstate issues, air pollution, that sort of thing that Ted raises, that those are perhaps ripe for federal judicial review and a Supreme Court decision. But it doesn't sound to me like all of these cases are necessarily all alike, and that would not have necessarily stopped the tobacco litigation. There were state legislative efforts that were very successful in curtailing that. It's not that there's just one answer to this kind of litigation, is it?
The problem, too, I think, not to pile on Elbert, I agree legislation can be very helpful, but because if one state passes legislation, the other states are seeking damages based on things happening in the state that passed the statute. That's really the clash, the chaotic clash I mentioned. And Chief Judge Pryor, you're right to focus on tobacco, because that's the analogy the plaintiffs in the states and municipalities keep using, and it breaks down in about 10 different ways, because first of all, the states and the municipalities, they're huge consumers of the product that they're claiming is creating a nuisance. They are consuming, they don't want to stop the use of oil and gas, they just want to take the money, and I completely agree with OH that this is an effort to skirt the legislative process, the federal legislative process, and to regulate using tort law.
Well, they didn't want to curtail tobacco sales either. They wanted to keep getting money from the industry.
Yes, yeah.
They just wanted more money.
Yes,
without raising taxes through the legislature.
And the other thing I would say on those cases, the myth is that those suits were so successful. None of them ever. It was all about the settlement pressure, and as you said, that it ends up with a settlement because
every one of them reached a state Supreme Court actually failed.
Yes.
So one thing I'll say is I think it's important to make a distinction between the road that they hoed to get here and then what they intend to do next. I think that the tobacco and opioids cases are examples of where people broke ground with profit motive. What I have seen come in since is interestingly deeply ideological. The people who were bringing the tobacco cases wanted money, and if the charts could be shown that if you kept the patient alive, you could get more, you could get more blood from them, they were fine with that. Most of the people not all, I think some of the people want the oil industry to keep going so they can take like royalties. You look at the places that are bringing these cases, whether it's Baltimore or Oregon or little counties, they would like the industries to die. They like talking about it from that perspective. And so I think they would like to have, there's a whole movement in the environmental space of just, you saw this they want everything to stay in the ground, right? And so I think as you've seen these new cases, the beef cases, right? These are people who truly believe they got to shut down all the carbon emissions, and how are they going to do it? You're going to make people stop farming. You can't make people stop wanting cows to eat, so you just make it impossible to grow. Right? So I think that...
Well, tell me this, though. The tobacco cases were, you say profit motive, that was a big part of it, but what happened was you had an alliance of trial lawyers, private trial lawyers, who were hired by state governments on contingent fee contracts.
Ah, yes, I forgot.
By the state governments. And, of course, those trial lawyers were often major contributors to the campaigns of the state attorneys generals who were filing the lawsuit. So the money issue was a big one. So are these suits all in-house suits?
No, it's worse. It's worse. So I call that the shady trial lawyer pipeline, Judge. I have some marketing help occasionally. What I think is revealing about this is the law firm of Cher Edling that receives donations from groups like the Arabella Network are the ones primarily representing the counties and cities. Now, they have a contingency fee contract in these cases, but they are a nonprofit donor-backed law firm that does just climate change cases. Who's bringing the plastics cases in California? A group called the Earth Island Institute that also receives nonprofit funding from left-wing ideological donors. So that helps reveal to me that these are not people who are they're not waiting until the settlement offer hits a certain price point, right? They're looking to vanquish their foes and obtain something. The same donors are donating to political campaigns and candidates and committees pushing the same topics, right? So I think that's deeply revealing to what the goal is. Now, that's not to say that every public nuisance case, whether it's the climate, the social media cases. I'm not sure they want to end social media. I think they might just view that like tobacco. But a lot of these cases, you know, you've got a case where the Mexican government, being represented by nonprofit lawyers, is trying to sue for gun manufacturers for guns that go to Mexico. As soon as I see donor-supported nonprofit law firms, I start thinking this isn't about money, and it's a lot more about ideology. Now, it's not a perfect, not every case is the same, and I agree, but that's why I think shutting it down in many states that's a good thing. But if I were thinking about the amount of effort put into this, I think as many of these cases as you can get up to the Supreme Court, you're not going to actually stop the ideological cases until you get...
But there's not necessarily a one global theory that the Supreme Court adopts that shuts right. down every species.
Except for
of
my
this.
Magical theory.
Well, right. I mean, Judge, I wanted to pick up on that. I mean, I think, so I agree with you. I mean, I think that's sort of the issue, right? I mean, the climate change cases, I think, are a good vehicle and should be granted, and I think that there is a path to a win there because there's the case law and the history about interstate emissions being a sort of a uniquely and inherently federal issue. I don't know that that necessarily applies to all of the theories that we're talking about, particularly when you're talking about products that don't necessarily, right, travel across state lines, opioids or lead paint or whatever, and then you run into, you know, the recent Dormant Commerce Clause cases, right? And the folks who tend to be our friends on the court, start asking what the textual hook is in the Constitution for overriding state law. So I think where I come down on this is, I guess I don't disagree that we need good vehicles and we need the Supreme Court to step in where it will. It denied cert in one of the lead paint cases that came out of the Ninth Circuit. But I think state legislation is part of the fix as well, because, I mean, you've...
One of the state laws that was passed in the midst of the tobacco wars was some of the states, the American Legislative Exchange Council particularly, was touting this. I think the first state maybe to pass it was North Dakota. They passed laws forbidding state attorneys general from hiring lawyers on contingency fee contracts.
Now that sounds pretty good.
You know, that was, and it was effective in some places. But it seems to me that and that could have effects then on many lawsuits, not just the tobacco lawsuit. So what's your response? I didn't mean to interrupt you, Albert, but what's your response to that?
I mean, I think this comes.
I have a response.
All right.
because the problem with the hiring of contingency fee lawyers skews the public interest. The rules are that if the attorney general or the locality, the government official maintains control, but it really completely throws things off. And kind of to your point, OH, the metrics and the incentives are completely thrown out the window. And so I think, you know, at least it helps in some instances because they can't make choices they wouldn't otherwise make.
Yeah. I mean, so look, I immediately think, Judge, states that then would just have to have a lot more budget support from the state legislature, and I support that. But at the end of the day, if Cher Edling signs a contingency fee contract with Multnomah County, Oregon, okay? If you ban contingency fee contracts, which, again, the problem I have is that you don't ban it in Oregon, it's just... The solutions are solving the problem in the places where they are potentially probably on the margin less of a problem. But even if you did, fine. Cheryl Lynch comes in and goes, it's amazing. I can represent you with my donor-backed resources to the tune of this flat rate of $50,000. How convenient. Don't need to look into it. Well, how are you doing that? Well, I have so much other profitable work at my firm And so you end up with Arabella Advisors hiring all the law firms for all the people, and they don't need to make any money because their goal is to shut it all down, right? So that, I think, I would love to see like a universal test case where you like ban outside contingency fee contracts, run the simulation, and see how many places still bring the cases, because that, I think, would actually be the revelation of whether it's money or ideology, and my bet would be that it's more ideology than money, but maybe it's more money than ideology, and I'm wrong. So I think shutting this down in a lot of states is perfectly good. What I worry about is that people get confused that if you remove half the liability, I mean, this goes back, so something that got lost in, so Ted will talk about this maybe. Sometimes you see these cases framed up as a consumer fraud violation, and then I think you'll see Ted start talking about how this wasn't a lie, this wasn't a misrepresentation, but I start worrying a lot less about them because I've brought those cases before. And in Arizona, you get a certain amount of money per misrepresentation, and to me, that starts to get to the, if places like California are gonna do enough of this stuff, companies are just gonna stop selling in California. And then I'm okay with that. It's bad for the people of California, but you know, they're allowed to live the progressive lifestyle dream. On the other side of this, the thing that gets really, really, really concerning to me about public nuisance is, going back to what Ted said, you ban public nuisance lawsuits in Iowa, and then somebody in California is saying you burned gas in Iowa and now you have to pay me for the Iowa gas, right? I at least want the theories of liability to be tied to like what you did in the place. And so if Albert's saying you're gonna bring a claim saying you sold the opioids in California, you gotta pay for that, fine, maybe people should just start leaving California. You know, one thing, I lost something earlier today and I can't find a Target, a Best Buy, or any of the stores that I recognize, a Walmart. You know, I'm from Arizona, we got a lot of these things. I can't find any of them anywhere near here or anywhere between here and the airport. I suspect it's because of a combination of, you know, the general crime waves in DC and the, you know, the only but they're just gone. They just left. And if that's how California wants to be, then they just leave. They stop selling opioids, they stop selling gas.
Okay. Well, are there any more comments that either Albert or Ted also want to make before we take some questions?
I'll just make one brief point because I think it's really important and it ties into what we're all talking about. California actually doesn't want to stop oil and gas from being used because, you know, we need it. There's only, the only way to survive is for there to be oil and gas production. The federal policy now and before, and I'm sure into the future, will be we need to produce more oil and gas in order to protect our country, to be independent. And so it's a little bit more insidious. The groups might want to stomp out oil and gas production now, but all these people that are suing, they know we need it. So they're really trying to have it both ways.
So this is where I think this gets to Ted and I's belief about the dark heart of certain people. When I hear a net zero by a certain date commitment, I always like to remind people that that means zero, okay? Now you can have a few offsets here and there, but when somebody says I want to be net zero or let's sign up to a net zero commitment by a certain date, the gas stations, they gotta go, right? And they'll have a discussion about how long the patient is kept alive until you get there. But when it's net zero, right? And so I actually think that they don't want oil and gas. Now they want you long enough to get to where they want to go, and then they want you dead.
Yeah, but I mean, some of this has got to be though specific litigation, you know, specific. Before we go further down this road, Albert.
I had mentioned the Dormant Commerce Clause before. I mean, I do think that one piece of this is going to be, you know, the court's going to have to address whatever that footnote was in Pork Producers about, you know, state law that applies extraterritorially, you know, specifically to conduct that's outside the state. And so that might be another piece to sort of.
We've got less than 15 minutes, so let's have some questions.
I'm John Hsu. I'm from Newport Beach, California. Thank you, gentlemen, for taking on this very important issue. Ted and Albert, in your view, would you please share what is the best way, from an originalist perspective, to go back to the original intent of public nuisance being tied to land, the king's land, and also for public nuisance that intervening criminal activities, criminals stealing the cars, criminals stealing or abusing the guns, what's the best way to get back to that in the courts? And then, OH, would you please share your thoughts on the fact that municipalities, putting aside that they're soft on crime policies recently, but the municipalities, when they do abatement, most of the abatement isn't done through the municipality itself, that it's done through special interest groups that are almost always left-wing special interest groups. So, for example, the city of Cincinnati for guns does not hire the NRA to do abatement. It hires a different group. Thank you very much.
Okay. First.
I'll start. I mean, I think unfortunately, the answer, right, is public nuisance is considered a common law cause of action. So I think the answer to your question is pass good laws and elect good judges.
Yeah, it's a province of common law, not constitutional law, so it's really not a question
right.
of originalism.
Right.
Is that, yeah, that's your point.
That's it, right. And so, I mean, it's a matter of, you know, you gotta have good judges who are gonna care about not expanding the common law in a way that completely blows up their role, and you've got to have, you know, state legislators that are willing to codify limitations on common law, which they can do.
And I would say that where the originalism really comes in play is on our constitutional structure argument. And our argument is that when we formed our union, the states each gave up some sovereignty, as the Supreme Court has said over and over again, and said you can legislate, you can do things with respect to your state and what happens in your state. What you can't do is tell, you know, my home state in North Dakota what to do if you're California. You can't say that there was too much oil and gas sold in those states. And that the franchise tax.
Yes, but that's an argument that might work if it's an interstate,
exactly.
international
yes.
problem, if it's the pollution problem,
exactly.
that sort of thing. But if it's the firearms industry,
it doesn't solve
distributing a lawful product. It doesn't necessarily work
That's exactly right. It really is you know, unique to interstate pollution and air uh-huh. and water. And so I have that on my mind. but that's exactly right. And I think that structurally, from an original standpoint, we are right and we should win. And it doesn't create dangers for those of you who care about federalism. It's very supportive of federalism. In fact, that's really the animating principle.
Okay, and OH about the municipalities.
Yeah, I mean, the name of my biggest report on public nuisance is Public Nuisance Revealed, the Left-Wing Plan to Reshape American Society, so it's not shocking that you pick a left-wing group to do a left-wing plan.
Okay, next question.
Sorry, I gotta maybe bend down a little. Hi, my name is Audrey. I am a Californian, not chasing the progressive lifestyle dream. I'm a 2L and a chapter president at UCLA. I'm actually taking a class right now on the role and importance of the state attorney general, and so commentary that I've heard about the tobacco litigation, et cetera, has been particularly intriguing when it comes to the issues that are arising in consumer protection. So my question's kind of more specific to state attorney generals. You know, we've seen class actions getting pretty significantly limited by the Supreme Court, and there's certainly a lot of dialogue that I hear at my school encouraging state attorney generals to start going a lot harder when it comes to these public nuisance cases, et cetera. So I'm curious if you could comment a little bit more on how, whether or not an expansion of the state attorney generals bringing more of these suits is a good or bad thing, and whether there are actually ways to limit that wouldn't violate a state's rights. I mean, we've heard about the possibility of legislation or the Supreme Court, so if you could comment a little bit more onto the basis of those limitations, I'd appreciate that.
I mean, you know, I will just start with, you know, I think it's dangerous for the attorneys general to have, for all the reasons we talk about public nuisance, it's so open-ended, it's so malleable, and when you're talking about the government coming after, you want to have fair notice, what's permitted, what's prohibited. So I think it's the wrong way to go. I'm from California too, and it was interesting to me, the General Motors auto case I mentioned, the Attorney General of California brought it. We won, and then in the meantime, Jerry Brown was elected Attorney General, and then he, very, from a practice standpoint, decided not to appeal and to drop it because he saw that it just didn't really make sense. It wasn't a way to achieve sensible policy. It's not a permissible. Who should decide? It shouldn't be federal courts or state courts. So I think they you know, I would encourage all the state attorneys general to not go down that road. Enforce the laws you have. They have consumer protection laws. They have statutes. But don't default. It's a sign of weakness to go to public nuisance.
That I agree with. I mean, when you really push somebody in a private room in a state and say, why did you bring public nuisance instead of Consumer Fraud mm-hmm. Act? Their answer will be, and in Arizona we don't have a statute of limitations on consumer fraud, but they would say, well, we had to get around the statute of limitations. Well, as best I could do. One thing I want to say that...
Or they might be filing a lawsuit where they know who the judge is, which was the case in Mississippi with tobacco.
Right. One thing I want to say that I was a little bit overly dismissive of state limits. A thing that I think is important on the... I'm very happy if you want to raise it up and say state AGs get to bring public nuisance claims, but not anybody else. That's like a... I see the value of that. Because the biggest thing that you'll notice is you just have started to see it. A very, very, very progressive city in a state that is very, very, very red with the public nuisance claim could wipe away products in that whole state. Something that would never pass the state legislature, someone that a governor would veto. The city of Austin has a path, with the way public nuisance is framed, to wipe away guns and super duties in the state of Texas. That's crazy. So maybe they shouldn't be allowed to do that. Maybe the statewide government should have to determine it. And so if a lot of what I'm describing is you're not going to stop all of public nuisance by passing bills across states, because I don't think you get all the states. But there's huge value in trying, if you're Texas.
Or West Virginia.
In at least stopping your college town from taking away everything in the rest of your state. That's at least something that you have a credible path to try to stop, and I think that's very salutatory.
Can I just one more climate anecdote, because it proves this point. In South Carolina, Charleston has brought one of these climate change cases, same theories. We're moving to dismiss that. The Attorney General of South Carolina filed an amicus brief in support of our cert petition and joined the original action saying these lawsuits should not be permitted.
That's so a really good example.
Exactly that clash.
I mean, West Virginia, it's Huntington and Morgantown, right? And so I think there is, there's so many issues here, and one of them is, in addition to the problem of public nuisance and all that, is the municipalities and the contingent fee. And it gets a little bit, I think, judged to what you're saying, which is, I think there's a lot of different ways to try to address this. Part of it is maybe going after contingent fees. Part of it is trying to consolidate these kinds of cases in the state AGs. And, you know, maybe they're pieces of the fix, but I think that it's important as you're trying to get your arms around this that it's not just one thing, right? It's a whole bunch of different problems.
All right, last question.
Yeah.
Oh, no, we'll have to. We'll have to quickly.
Yeah, sure. So I'm Connor Fraley, 3L at UNC, was the chapter president last year. My question, mostly for OH, I think I agree with almost everything you said there. I'm writing a piece right now on kind of full faith and credit and how that might help with some of these state extraterritoriality type stuff. Like, I love your, like, hey, this is a national thing, but like, what's your hook? Mm-hmm. What's your hook for this limitation? Is it dormant commerce? Because it's not a textual hook. And
no, it's inspired by the Second Circuit's decision that Ted explained very, very well.
I think he just asked you to write his paper for him.
Yeah, sure. it's inspired by Ted's kind of, okay, look, they're common law claims, okay? And there's a fundamental, I mean, I'm not as doctrinally stupendous as the two men here on the stage, all three men on the stage, other than myself, but if you have a common law claim and the thing you're trying to solve is nationwide in scope, one of the things that triggers federal common law, amongst others, is where you need to have a uniform answer to the question at hand. I can think of no more simplistic illustration of that than if you have a nuisance and the nuisance in question is federal, you need to have uniform analysis of whether it is a nuisance and how to fix that nuisance. So the minute you say it's a nationwide nuisance, you get a nationwide federal common law claim of nuisance. Now, Ted has a very detailed, there's all sorts of briefing, I'm not sure I agree with all of it, about how the Clean Air Act supplants it, but at a minimum, it needs to be a federal standard governed by federal courts, and then if a federal court says it's a political question, we're done. So I think it's as simple as that. I don't see how you have nationwide nuisances solved by local common law claims. Federal common law is exactly for this. I know it's not a big area of law, but it's for this.
Yeah, and that's basically what the Supreme Court has said, that there may or may not be a cause of action, but it's federal common law and federal law that governs. And the AEP case is really amazing because it's you know, ideologically, you know, unified opinion. It's Justice Ginsburg talking about how these are scientific issues, you need experts, the EPA is made for this, and And this is not something that courts should do, so we're not going to allow there to be a cause of action under federal common law, even though federal common law is the body we look to.
Yeah, I should be clear that when I say that Supreme Court solves this by saying these claims are only for local harms, it's because they say if it's federal, if it's nationwide, if it's international, that's federal common law, and federal common law doesn't allow you to bring a nuisance claim like this on any topic. This is where the Clean Air Act matters less to me.
Right.
On any topic, it's supplanted by federal common law, and we don't have a federal common law claim to do what you're trying to do.
I agree.
Last question.
There is a Harvard Law Review or Harvard Journal of Environmental Law or whatever article from last year that argues that there should be climate homicide claims brought against energy companies. And speaking of the creativity of lawyers earlier, and of course, accompanied
by
civil asset
forfeiture.
I'm curious for your thoughts on what the other avenues are if this closes and what courts should be thinking about as that comes up.
Not homicide. We agree that's off the table.
Mere manslaughter.
No. Well, and again, the absurdity is, these are people who are using oil and gas, consuming every day, saying, somebody else should be nailed for homicide. But I do think it's a very difficult policy question that has to be dealt with. It can be dealt with at the state level and limiting emissions within the state and regulating, but the overarching issues have to be decided nationally and internationally. It's a hard question, and we need to address it through that means.
Yeah, I mean, one of the answers to why nuisance and sort of tort became less of a sort of regulatory factor is because there is regulation, right? I mean, this whole conference has been about pushing back on the administrative state, right? But there's a place for government regulation, and part of the problem here is that, and this gets to the ideological point, they're unhappy, right, with what EPA can do and what Congress has been doing, and that they can't get those kinds of laws through, and so they resort to these to these creative theories. So it's not like there's not a solution. There's lots of other paths to get to the outcome they want. It's just that they can't succeed at it.
And the AEP court made the point that there is a role for the courts. There's a judicial review process. A citizen can bring a case saying the EPA should have done more or less. There is a role for the courts, but it's through that mechanism.
I would just say, if I were Albert, I would just hold up a card that just says causation in response to every new claim, because in this space, the climate space at least, the causation chain for public nuisance, for homicide, I mean, what? Like, you sell a product that's legal. That's so important. A legal regulated product, and then da-da-da-da-da-da, the gnomes, like, liability. And you're like, what? That's not a thing, because we have causation. We have causation on torts. You have to have something in the criminal space. You would never allow a criminal conviction for murder or manslaughter at that level for a legal product. I think it would be different if they're selling an illicit product that they know is like a 99% death rate, but they've not.
All right. So please join me in thanking our panel.
Thank you. It's fun to be on the bench.